The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The reviews were in before opening day, and they weren't good. It's too serious, too convoluted, too much destruction. But the warnings did not keep Batman versus Superman from beating box office records.
He has the power to wipe out the entire human race, and if we believe there's even a 1% chance that he is our enemy, we have to take it as an absolute certainty. And we have to destroy him.
Ticket sales did fall precipitously after opening weekend, but director Zack Snyder's superhero slugfest is a textbook blockbuster, so far bringing in more than $800 million worldwide. Zachary Crockett is a writer for Vox. He wanted to know how Batman v Superman stacked up next to other high-grossing, poorly reviewed films, and discovered an interesting trend. Big-budget movies are getting worse. Zachary Crockett, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, great to be here.
So for full disclosure, you have not yet seen Batman v Superman? Have I got that right?
That's correct. I think the bad reviews scared me away a little bit.
Well, Zachary, there are a lot of ways that we can break down the numbers of how much movies make and how they're reviewed. Now, so how did you do it? What were you looking for?
So basically, we wanted to find the films that grossed these tremendous amounts of money, $250 million or more, but also got terrible reviews by critics. And we wanted to find a happy medium between those two numbers. So what we did is we took the total money that a film made in the box office, and this is international figures adjusted for inflation, and then we divided by the Metacritic score. Metacritic takes an aggregate of all of these famous film critics' reviews and creates a 0 to 100 point scale. 0 is terrible, 100 is fantastic. So we took the total gross that the movie made in the box office and divided it by this Metacritic score. And what that gave us was a dollars per point metric. So it tells us how much a film grossed relative to the review that it got.
Okay, so looking at that dollar per point metric, what are some of the big winners slash, I guess, losers on your list?
So the big winners would be films, cultish films like Star Wars, the original Star Wars from 1997. You have The Godfather really high up there. And then the big losers are films like Grown Ups 2, Transformers, Age of Extinction, Pirates of the Caribbean.
So where did Batman v Superman fall in terms of this dollar per point metric?
Well, when we plotted all this out, we were kind of shocked to see that Batman v Superman was 20th all time on this list. At that time, the gross was around $680 million, and Batman had a score of 44 in Metacritic. So you take that $680 million, divide it by 44, and it works out to about $15.5 million per point that they're spending. So, and actually, since then, as of this morning, Batman vs. Superman has now grossed $827 million worldwide. So I'm happy to report that Batman v Superman just cracked the top 10 this morning.
Wowie. Well, I've seen similar sort of analyses for how much candidates are spending, for example, per each vote mm-hmm. that they're actually getting. But what do you think you're measuring with this dollar per point metric? I mean, culturally speaking, is it the triumph of marketing over taste, or in the case of some of these, maybe the power of a well-known franchise? Certainly names like Batman and Superman are going to draw people to the movies.
The majority of the top 20, 30 on this list are franchise films. They're, films like The Smurfs or
Ice Age, I'm seeing
Godzilla or Twilight, films that have built this cult following around certain characters that people want to see on a recurring basis, regardless of the quality of the film, regardless of the reviews that it gets. It almost becomes like social capital to just go see this film and know what's going on with your favorite character.
Well, there is an argument that could be made that people are, in effect, voting for a film when they buy a ticket. So could the counter argument be that movies are not actually getting worse, but the critics are becoming more elitist or maybe removed from what is popular?
Absolutely. I drew one conclusion from this data, but it could just as easily be said that, it's the critics who are rearranging their expectations about what an artistic film should be. And it's interesting how much clout movie chair pundits have in determining what is a good movie and what is not a good movie. If you look at reviews, interestingly, there's a very, very wide disparity between user reviews and critic reviews.
Hmm. But you also said blockbusters are getting worse. So that suggests a devolution. Was there a time when critics adored these blockbusters?
So that's the interesting thing. We took this list that we compiled, and we plotted out by decade the average Metacritic score for these big budget blockbusters. And basically what we found is if you go back to the 1970s, the average film that grossed the equivalent of $250 million or more received a score of 85 out of 100 points. But since the 1970s, these numbers have been really on decline, and today the average is around 55. But I should say that, as some of our readers pointed out, that could be selection bias. Many older films from the 70s and 80s aren't on Metacritic. A lot of the older films on Metacritic tend to be the best ones, the ones that people remember, the ones that are nostalgic. But nonetheless, I mean, this trend is very obvious, and whether or not it's declining because films are getting worse or because critics are becoming more stodgy about what they deem to be artistic is an interesting question.
So, Zachary, now that Batman v Superman has broken the top 10 of highest grossing worst films, any plans to go see it?
Well, I definitely have to now. Maybe I'll help out their ailing ticket sales a little bit.
Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Sure, thank you.
Zachary Crockett, he writes for Vox. And if you'd like to see it for yourself with the charts and the graphs supporting his argument that big budget movies are getting worse, you'll find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Not every movie is a blockbuster. Some are so bizarre that they never make it to the big or even small screen. Many end up at Oddball Film and Video. That's a stock footage company with an archive that includes everything from vintage erotica to quirky after-school specials. Producer Jenny Butler takes us inside.
I'm standing in front of what looks like a secondhand furniture store in San Francisco's Mission District. A small sign on a nondescript door reads, Oddball Film and Video, second floor. At the top of these stairs is the largest film archive in Northern California, but you never know it. I'm led into a small warehouse with seemingly endless rows of 16mm film reels. They're stacked floor to ceiling with no clear organization.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Fine.
A slender man with glasses sits behind the front desk.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
That's Stephen Parr, the man behind this entire operation.
There you go.
Great,
you know
thanks.
Every Thursday and Friday night, Parr invites the public inside his archive for screenings, compilations of short films under a single theme. Tonight is Strange Cinema, a monthly screening of Oddball's most unusual footage. We cozy up on old barbershop chairs and battered couches in the archive's back room, which is lit by a rotating disco ball hanging from the ceiling. This makeshift theater seats about 30 people, and tonight, almost every seat is filled.
Is anybody here for the first time? Great. My name's Steven, welcome. Tonight's program is something that I put together and been thinking about for a long time.
In tonight's lineup, we'll see experimental films either made in the Far East or influenced by Eastern films. Parr describes some as whimsical, others as spacey, and one as a film the audience will never want to see again. Then the lights go out.
Which depicts every delicate movement of the Indian classical dance. Here at a dance school,
An Indian drama appears on a pull-down screen. The characters have painted faces and elaborate costumes and are telling stories through dance. Parr founded Oddball nearly 30 years ago. At the time, he was a video artist, making background images for nightclubs and galleries. He was tired of searching for materials from other archives, so he started his own. Soon, producers of Hollywood movies, commercials, music videos, and television wanted access to Parr's eccentric footage, so he made a business out of it.
My intent really was to create a small community of people who are interested in sharing a visual experience and really kind of experiment and push forward the context of cinema.
The idea is to take the audience's expectations about film and turn them upside down. Many of Oddball's films don't fit into traditional genres. Some have alternative story structures. Some have no story at all.
So a lot of the films that we screen here are some films are educational uses. Some films are made for instructional purposes. But when you put them into another context, they kind of bounce off each other and create a kind of a unique viewing experience.
A unique viewing experience, like a Japanese fable about a family of ants and a lazy grasshopper.
In a nearby garden, the girl ants are finding some tasty ant food.
Most of Parr's collection was donated from people who decided their films were worthless or that the medium was just too much work to keep.
Almost every film has some form of a redeeming quality in some way, even if that quality is that you should never make a film that way.
Since Oddball began in 1984, the archive has screened more than 800 unique programs and developed a loyal following. Tom Gilroy, a filmmaker from New York, has been to 5 screenings in the 6 weeks he's been in town.
I was blown away basically because nothing like this really exists in New York. And I'm not really aware of anything existing like this in the United States. It's kind of like a museum visit, a history lesson, an entertainment outing, but then an odd kind of theater experience.
And maybe that's why fans keep coming back to Oddball. Because no matter how many times they return to the archive's back room, they'll never see the same thing twice.
Don't be foolish. Let's get started. Papa's waiting for
us. And that piece was produced by Jenny Butler. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It may sound like a spoof, but Naked and Afraid is a big hit for the Discovery Channel. We'll let them explain the premise.
Two strangers.
There's my partner.
One man and one woman, both experienced survivalists, have chosen to put their skills to the ultimate test. They have no water, no food, and no clothes. Their challenge is to survive for 21 days.
God, we're so screwed.
Can a man and woman survive alone in the wilderness, naked and afraid?
Yep, kind of like Survivor, but buck naked, which is tricky on network TV. John Coughlin covers TV for the New York Times, and he wrote about the team that it takes to sufficiently blur out the naughty bits for Naked and Afraid. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So blurring, that's the visual effect of erasing, in this case, anything that could identify sexuality. How much work goes into blurring just one episode of Naked and Afraid?
A lot. Actually, it takes a team, a full-time team of 5 people, and as much as 50 hours a week in order to do all the blurring. They have to sit there in the Sherman Oaks office, a sort of dark office, and go frame by frame to make sure they catch every single bit of nudity that could slip through the cracks, so to speak.
You call them the Blur Man Group. Who are they? What do they do?
They actually call themselves the Blur Man Group, so I'll give them credit for that. They're visual effects artists. They're people who live in Los Angeles, who've been bouncing around jobs in television or movies for the last 15 or 20 years. Most of them are in their 40s or 50s. And, you know, it's if they wouldn't be working there, they could be conceivably working at Pixar or something like that. They actually, you know, at first I wanted to call them editors when it came to writing the piece, and they told me, we're not editors, we're artists, we're designers. Hmm. So it's actually pretty interesting, because when you think of a blur, you think of something like Cops, or you think of editing out a company's logo on a T-shirt or something like that. But here, you know, it's a lot more sophisticated. They do regard it as an art.
Well, they are spending all their time looking at and erasing breasts and genitalia and bottoms. I mean, I'm trying to imagine what kind of conversations they have in a workday. You visited the office. What did you observe?
It's really strange. So when I walked into the office, and they share an office, or they share an office building with Steve Carell's production company, which is right upstairs, you walk in and suddenly you see a giant laptop and you see breasts, or you will see a penis, and it's blown up because they have to sit there and edit it out. Then you'll go to one of their colleagues' workstations and you'll see a spreadsheet which will say, you know, more opaque crotch blur for him, or boob blurs insufficient. And there are literally dozens of these directives. It's very, very, very weird, to say the least. And they acknowledge it. You know, one of the people I talked to, he said, you know, what work environment can you say, oh, my God, look at that penis. And it's totally cool. And nobody has to call up HR. You know, it's funny because they also talk about how there's a numbness to seeing either breasts or a penis all day long, and they don't even notice it anymore. I'm not sure if I 100% believe them, but, you know, they tried to sell me on that case.
Well, the job does require a lot of responsibilities. I mean, networks could get in big trouble with the FCC for insufficient blurring. Has anything like that happened yet?
They claim not, but after Naked and Afraid debuted, which was in 2013, and it was a rating success, other naked reality TV shows came to be. VH1 had one called Dating Naked, and a woman on the show actually sued VH1 and Viacom and the production company behind Dating Naked, claiming that her crotch had been insufficiently blurred. That case was eventually thrown out, but, you know, Discovery is not Showtime after midnight. This is a family network. They can't let this stuff get on the air. So that's why they have to be so aggressive and so careful about editing each frame. And it takes a lot of time. And one of the producers on the show told me that, you know, if it were a few years ago, if this were 10 or 15 years ago, we'd be fine. But the fact that we live in the age of the DVR and the TiVo, if you suddenly press pause at the wrong frame and see a nipple or see a penis, they'll be in very big trouble.
Mm. Well, you mentioned the success of Naked and Afraid has inspired other naked shows. There's Dating Naked, there's Naked Vegas, there's Naked Office. Well, you know, so blurring could become a really specialized field, couldn't it?
It very well could be. At the very least, it is right now. And, you know, a lot of that speaks to television in general. There's never been more scripted and unscripted television ever. I mean, last year, for instance, in the scripted universe, there were 412 shows. Reality shows, there are a lot of them as well. And it's created, you know, sort of this economy for people who otherwise would be bouncing around jobs. You know, these five full-time blurs, I believe three of them have been with the show for close to 3 years. And one of the people who is part of the Blur Man group kept on saying to me over and over again, I am so grateful. I am so grateful for this job.
Mm. Well, that is the upside, but I'm trying to imagine, you know, meeting someone and saying, so what do you do? I mean, did they admit it, or does that sound just a little pervy?
They did admit it. And I asked them this several different ways and times. What happens, you know, when you're at a barbecue, it's the 4th of July, and somebody asks what you do, and they said that it always dominates every single conversation. One of the people I spoke to, part of the Blur Man group, said that he went on a cruise recently, and he and his girlfriend spent the better portion of a week speaking exclusively about Naked and Afraid and the craziest things he ever saw.
Well, John Coblin reports on television for the New York Times. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
You'll find a link to read his article for staff on Naked and Afraid, Work is Just a Blur, at wordofmouthradio.org. In a recent article for Broadly, Mitchell Sunderland writes that 21 reality TV stars have committed suicide over the past 10 years. Now, that's compared to an average of 12.93 suicides for every 100,000 Americans in the general population back in 2014. As reality television continues to grow, gobbling up more and more network hours, that extraordinarily high suicide rate indicates a growing mental health problem within the community. Sunderland's article profiled the wellness coach, Allison Barnard, whose work is now focused on this very visible, though clearly vulnerable population. And she's on the line to tell us more about her work. Allison, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been a wellness coach for nearly 10 years. 3 years ago is when you began the Luminary program. Now, what is that?
So the Luminary program is via phone, and we essentially spend time mapping out systems and practices that will help the reality star. So I cover things like, how do you help your family and friends transition as you become a star? How do you cope with a loss of anonymity? How do you set good boundaries? How to be careful with money? And a big one is how to be careful with social media and how to avoid isolation and how to create a team of people around you who are there to support you and mentor you.
So why this particular program in this particular community? Were you responding to a need that you saw in this community? Did you come to it by chance? I'm curious.
Well, it was a combination of things. I grew up when reality television first started. And as the years have gone on, I noticed that people were marketing themselves like never before. And these are very real people with very real struggles, kind of putting themselves out there for public consumption and to at sometimes become news headlines. And it didn't take much time for me to realize that there was a need for this type of support. I'm not a therapist and was very clear about creating a program that offered support and tools for transitioning into public life. So, you know, it's a small number of people. It really is in the grand scheme of things, but it's an important group to be supporting because of the effect that they have on their viewers.
That's an important point. I mean, the number of reality TV shows has skyrocketed since the early 2000s. So a lot of people are watching them. But mental health in particular as an issue for people who appear on these shows. Do you think that there are, I don't know, what is it that makes them more susceptible? Do you think there's something about the character or personality of someone who's in a reality TV show that makes them more vulnerable?
Well, first you have to think about why they do it. So usually people who sign up for reality shows are people who believe that they really know themselves fairly well. There sometimes is a component of stability that they have to have in order to have the courage to be on a reality show. But at times, there are shows that sort of seek people who have that courage, but maybe have some slight emotional instability, or sometimes they seem completely emotionally stable, but they bring something unique to the cast of characters that they're trying to find. A lot of times, these people have something that they want to market. It might be business, or it might just be themselves. But when they're forced to interact with people who they might not normally choose to, this cast of characters that's been chosen for a show, that can propel them toward acting in ways that they wouldn't normally, thus creating the drama needed on the show. So
yeah, that makes for good television if you think about it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. So a lot of times it's not so much that the networks are looking for people who are unstable, it's that they put them in such a unique situation that it's almost impossible to remain stable under those conditions because it's a social experiment and it can be really difficult to witness yourself in that situation on the air.
Well, you mentioned, Allison, social media, creating this environment where stars are interacting more and more with the people who are watching them. Mm-hmm. How is that affecting their sense of self?
Well, okay. So a lot of people have given me the feedback that if you don't know who you are, the public can define you. However, it's also true that whoever you are at your core You become an amplified version of that. So you start to feel this very real piece of yourself get stronger, but at the same time, you're dealing with a society watching a show that, even though there's a part of them that knows it isn't real, they kind of think it's real, and they talk publicly as though it is. And a lot of reality stars are susceptible to producers and editors kind of creating the narrative on the show that they want with these very real personalities. But then these reality stars, they bear the brunt of that public reaction when they read what's in the tabloids or they read what's on social media. And that piece is where it can get very sketchy for reality stars, because there's some people who are vulnerable to thinking, gosh, this whole group of people thinks that this is how I am. Is that how I am? And that's when you start to see reality stars start to act out and start to self-medicate and start to get really scared. And a big piece of my work is to be there on the front end of that reaction and really prepare them for what is the difference between who you know you are and who society is starting to say you are. And at some point, there may come a time where therapy is really critical.
So you said you're helping them sort of on the front end, you know, as they're becoming famous. What sort of resources do networks provide for the people on reality shows?
You know, I can't say personally because I'm not speaking directly to a lot of the networks, but I can say that a lot of my clients and a lot of people I interviewed have simply said there's just not enough. I get the sense that there just isn't a clear enough preparation for what's coming down the road for these people when they sign up. And it really is possible to explain it. There's even reality shows overseas in the UK, for instance. And at the very beginning of the show, they say some of this content is scripted or not everything that you're going to see is real. And just that one sentence can provide these reality stars an opportunity to say, and legally be able to say, well, that moment wasn't really what happened. And that allows them to maintain their sense of self. So I think that there's an opportunity for the networks to do a lot more. And it's to their benefit to see these reality stars thoughtfully signing another year contract instead of finding people who are feeling stuck, like they have to sign another one. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does make sense. And you know, it also makes sense that there's a real difference between people who are on traditional television and movies, that they are playing a role. They know they're playing a role. Mm-hmm. And I think that people are probably encouraged to play the most outrageous parts of themselves on reality TV. But that opens up something, Allison. I mean, you know, I'm not the only person who's looked at a lot of reality television shows and thought, oh, seriously? There's a show about, you know, overweight American hog farmers who live in trailer parks and hang out. You know what I mean? The kind of craziness. There's a little sense of like, okay, you're putting yourself in this role. Is this a portion of the population that also doesn't get so much sympathy from the rest of us?
Yeah, and that's understandable. I think that with shows like that, first of all, there's a number of times that reality stars or reality talent has been told that the show is going to be something very different than what it ends up being. And once they sign that contract, it's not only a non-disclosure, so they can't say certain things, but they can't even, they just can't defend themselves in the way that they would like to. At the same time, we all know someone who is struggling, and we all have someone in our lives who maybe is drinking too much or who is eating too much or is doing something to cope with some sense of pain that they're struggling with. And sometimes, definitely not all of them, I have to be so clear about that, but sometimes people who go on reality shows are struggling with something. I understand the natural inclination to think, well, you signed up for this, but sometimes it is not what they signed up for. It really isn't. Sometimes they think that they're doing something good or they're doing something fun. Sometimes they're just coping with some sense of themselves that is not in a good place. But that again is where we as the viewers have to be so careful in judging these people, because they're people and they deserve as much support as they can, especially when it's being done for the viewers' consumption benefit.
Allison Barnard, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Allison Barnard, she's a wellness coach and founder of the Luminary Program, which focuses on helping reality TV stars transition from their public lives and maintain balance before and after shooting a series. We found out about her work through Mitchell Sunderland's article, The Woman Teaching Reality TV Stars How Not to Go Crazy on Broadly. You'll find a link to read that article on Broadly, along with a link to more on the Luminary Program at wordofmouthradio.org. This April marks the 20th anniversary of National Poetry Month, started by the Academy of American Poets in 1996, and has since become one of the largest literary celebrations in the world. So coming up after the break, we're going to celebrate a local poet with Catherine Towler. Her new book shares the story of her complicated friendship with one of Portsmouth, New Hampshire's poet laureates.
He was a person who put his art first. He put his poetry first, and I think people admired that. And people knew him because he didn't have a car. He walked everywhere. He was someone people simply knew as part of the streetscape of Portsmouth, and he had a wonderful wit.
Getting to know the enigma that was Robert Dunn, the penny poet of Portsmouth, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you've ever visited Prescott Park in Portsmouth, maybe you've walked out to the pier overlooking the Piscataqua River and seen the plaque that says, "From here you can see the tide turn like a door on its hinges."
From here you can see the tide turn like a door on its hinges. We're just going out. Do you want anything from the ocean?
That's the voice of Robert Dunn reading his poem, From Here You Can See. Dunn was Portsmouth's poet laureate from 1999 to 2001, and he was both a fixture and an enigma, often seen walking the streets of the rough-edged town, long before Starbucks and the gift shops took up residence, or the New York Times praised its absurd selection of restaurants and cafes. The writer Catherine Towler moved to Portsmouth at the onset of that boom and was intrigued by Dunn, living in a single room without an electrical outlet and selling his hand-bound poetry collections for a penny. Her new book, The Penny Poet of Portsmouth, recounts their unfolding relationship as her life and the seaside town transformed. And Catherine Towler, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. It's good to be here.
So you first saw Robert Dunn there, kind of shambling along the streets, brushing by you with barely an acknowledgement at one point. You assumed he was homeless, but he wasn't. Who was he, and how did he live?
So Robert was a poet, and that was the primary focus of his life, was his writing. And he read a great deal. He was one of the most widely read people I have ever met. And he worked a few hours each afternoon at the Portsmouth Athenaeum. And, well, I saw him first on the streets when I moved to Portsmouth, as you describe, and then I met him as my neighbor. I discovered that he lived next door to me, where he had the single room in the house he rented. And through meeting him as my neighbor, and then also as a fellow writer, that I got to know him a little bit. He was a hard person to get to know.
You write about him seeming to you so much like a person from another century and this town from another century. And there's a lot of connection about people and place here in your book. You're both living in this scrappy, you know, somewhat rundown town as it was becoming gentrified. The J.J. Newbery's closes, becomes a Gap. The A&P closes. But he was, as you came to find out, quite treasured in this town. Why?
He was a person who put his art first. He put his poetry first, and I think people admired that. And people knew him because he didn't have a car. He walked everywhere. So he was someone you saw almost daily walking around town. He was someone people simply knew as part of the streetscape of Portsmouth, And he had a wonderful wit. He was very, very funny, very smart, a brilliant mind. And people admired him for leading a very alternative life and for writing his wonderful poems, which he shared at poetry readings and in his little penny books, which he sewed by hand. And he would sell them on the street in Market Square. If you happened to run into him and he had a new book, he would pull it out of the pocket of his trench coat, which he always wore. He was famous for that trench coat and his flat cap.
And I think you tried to give him, what, a dollar once for one of his penny books?
Well, when he had a new penny book, and I ran into him in Market Square, and he took it out of his pocket, and he said, "I have that book for you." And I didn't realize at first which book. And then I realized, oh, it's his new little penny book, which I had been eagerly waiting for and looking forward to. And I think I tried to give him $5, and he refused that. Anyway, he finally, I think, did end up taking a dollar from me.
He was the kind of guy that gave the town character on some level, but really inscrutable in some ways. But you did get to know him in at least a tentative way. Why was that so surprising to you?
I was surprised, I guess, because at the end of his life, Robert was quite ill. And he was ill for 3 years, in and out of the hospital and the rehab unit at the assisted living facility. And he turned to me and in some ways almost appointed me as his next of kin, the person who the doctors and the social workers had authorization to talk to or to call in an emergency. And I puzzled over why me. So I guess that was what was surprising me. He was such a private person. He wasn't that easy to get to know, and yet he did open up to me to a degree in those last years.
Well, this is a man who never appeared to need friends. I mean, certainly didn't want charity from anybody or even health insurance from his employers at the Athenaeum. But he was a heavy smoker, had some pulmonary troubles, emphysema. And this failing health kind of increased this vulnerability that vanished, that careful distance he had. I think you call it the silent insistence that the world came to him. There's a real power in that, isn't there, in that kind of remove?
Oh, sure. There's a great power in it. And Robert sort of dictated the terms on which he would open up to people, and he dictated the terms in which he would share his writing. So he was not like many writers looking for fame. He did not care that much about how his work was published. He wanted to connect with readers. And so he did remain an enigmatic person, and there is a sort of power in that, you know? He controlled how people knew him and what they knew about him.
That kind of leads us to another, I think, really powerful theme in the book. There's this tension in your own life as you tried to stick to your writing while now married, you know, learning how to be married, now a member of a community. Could you read a bit from the book about that?
Well, this is from chapter 11, and it's after Robert has become sick, and so he's not able to walk around town as much. And at the beginning of this chapter, I'm walking into town on a December evening, and I'm thinking about how Robert is missing on the streets of Portsmouth and how I am missing seeing him there. There's an irony in our looking to someone like Robert, who deliberately defined himself outside the mainstream of human life, to tell us about the living of that life. This person watching from the sidelines should, it seems, be the least qualified to illuminate our experience, but this is what we ask of writers. The ones who produce the most lasting books are often ruthless at separating themselves from the world. In this riddle lies the uncertainty at the heart of the writer's work. We have no right to make claims for the rest of our human brothers and sisters, but this is precisely what we do. We plant a flag at the summit of human experience. We assert that though we might be quiet, watchful types prone to lurking in corners, we have some insight into the lives of our more active neighbors that gives us the license to tell their stories. Solitude is not a recipe by itself for good writing, nor does good writing necessarily require solitude. But often when these elements come together at the highest levels, something sublime occurs. Robert is a good example. He was beloved as a poet among those who knew his work in New Hampshire and beyond because he had his finger on the pulse of a few significant truths and translated them into language that, though the voice might have been quirky and unpredictable, was instantly recognizable as our own common language. He stood outside the world while giving it back to us whole.
That's Catherine Towler reading from The Penny Poet of Portsmouth. This is her memoir, charting her unfolding relationship with the poet Robert Dunn. It's an elegy of sorts to an eccentric poet and for the town, which inspired and ultimately took care of him. He died in 2008. Well, Robert was reclusive, seemed not to care about the success and the recognition and the material trappings of fame, which made you, you're writing and publishing three novels, you're going out on book tours, feel somewhat suspect in his eyes. Now, what did that mean for you?
He was a challenge. You know, the way Robert lived his life with such incredible integrity was a challenge, I think, to anyone, but particularly to me as a writer. He made me think about what was most important and why was I writing? What was it I most wanted? So did fame come first or did the writing come first? He put the writing first. He wasn't doing it to get recognition from others. He was doing it for the pure art of it. And that was why I felt sometimes that he was observing me and how caught up I was in caring about what others thought of my writing and trying to, you know, impress other people with my work instead of simply focusing on the work itself and doing the work that I needed to be doing without thought of how it would be received.
But it seems like you observed a cost in being that single-minded about your work, too.
I did. So for me, the process of writing the book was coming to understand my own admiration for Robert. I had admired him so much in the first years when I knew him, and I held him up as an ideal. But when he became sick, I saw the cost of that kind of single-minded devotion. I saw the cost of how he had lived financially on so little. He did not have a family. He did not have a partner. And he was very alone at the end of his life, at a time when he needed other people. And so it made me reevaluate my admiration of him and think about that ideal of, you know, the single-minded devotion to your art. And it made me appreciate perhaps the more complex nature of my life, the fact that I had gotten married and had a life that was more full of people than his life.
Do you think he really didn't care if anyone read his poems, if they were recognized?
No, I think he did care. He wanted his poems to be read by people. He wanted to share them, and he found ways to do that. But he made, in some ways, a calculated choice to do that in the small scale in New Hampshire and Portsmouth, and not to get caught up in trying to gain recognition more widely.
I think there's a point in the book where you reflect on buying your home with your husband and think, like, we got in at just the right time, right? Before all the property values skyrocketed and, you know, the upscale chain stores had moved in. And I couldn't help but wonder if his life was perfectly timed for that place. You know, would it be possible for a writer to live as he did so close to the bone in today's Portsmouth?
No, it wouldn't be possible. His rental situation, renting a single room in a house within walking distance of downtown today, I think would be virtually impossible to find a place that was that affordable. And you're right, it was an accident of time for him as well, that he came to Portsmouth when he did, when it was a place where you could live more reasonably. It had not been as discovered and gentrified and developed as it has been today.
Just in closing, I'm thinking of that sort of hunger for, you know, fame, recognition. Knowing this, going through the process of reflecting on Robert's life and the community that he had around him or didn't have around him, how do you look at that sort of quest or hunger for success now?
Well, I think my view of it is also tempered by being older and realizing that success in the eyes of the wider world can be very fleeting. It can be satisfying, but not something that will lead to long-term contentment or happiness. And so I think I have made a greater peace in my own mind with trying to be a bit more like Robert. I'm not quite like him, but trying to be a bit more like him in focusing on the work and trying to make the work of the highest quality I can make it. Obviously, I want to get published, and I want my work to go out into the world, but trying to stay very focused on the work itself in doing that.
Well, Catherine Towler, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us about it.
Thank you very much, Virginia.
Catherine Towler is author most recently of the memoir, The Penny Poet of Portsmouth, and she's reading from and talking about the book all over the region in the coming weeks. She'll be at Water Street Books in Exeter on May 5th. More details are at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. What goes on in the brain of a poet? For Walt Whitman, discerning the workings of his own mind was a passion. Producer Michelle Legro brings us the story of the strange journey of Walt Whitman's brain, both inside his head and out.
This is the story of a brain, a journey of an exuberant mind housed in a well-rounded skull. This is the story of the death of that brain and what happened next. Before he published Leaves of Grass, Walt Whitman had struggled for years as a poet. He understood there was something timeless, something limitless about what it meant to be alive in the world, but he didn't yet have the words. Then he found phrenology. One summer afternoon, a young Whitman crossed the river to Manhattan and made his way to a small storefront at 308 Nassau Street. This was the cabinet of Fowler and Wells, America's most famous phrenologists. By measuring bumps on the skull, they promised to reveal one's truest personality. When Lorenzo Fowler reached into Whitman's curly hair, he discovered a large and perfectly rounded head. Whitman's phrenological chart proved he was exceptional.
Amativeness, 6. Adhesiveness, 6. Self-esteem, 6-7.
Phrenology gave Whitman the vocabulary he needed to finish Leaves of Grass. But what can one know of a man from his skull? Not much. Phrenology soon fell out of fashion. Towards the end of the century, a new wave of headhunters appeared. Curious surgeons who wanted to remove and preserve the brain itself. Their goal? To pinpoint the location of genius in a celebrated mind. By then, Walt Whitman had suffered a stroke and moved to Camden, New Jersey. As the famous poet lay dying, among his many visitors were a group of Philadelphia surgeons called the Brain Society, who hoped to make his brain the centerpiece of their collection. It's unclear if Whitman intended to donate his brain to science, but this much is certain. No one told his brother George. When the surgeons showed up to collect their prized specimen, George sent them away, but then made the mistake of leaving town. The surgeons returned. They took the brain. Today, the Society's collection of preserved brains sits forgotten in the basement of Philadelphia's Wistar Museum. According to the autopsy report, Whitman's brain should be there too, but it's not. No one really knows what happened to the brain of Walt Whitman. Some say it was dropped in the lab, others that it was slipped into a bag in Camden, ferried across the river, that when it came out, it just wasn't quite the same. But even if the surgeons had saved Whitman's brain, what was it exactly they'd hoped to find? They could have weighed it, measured its lobes, but in the end, the brain men, like the phrenologists, failed to discover what makes us so uniquely, joyfully ourselves. Because if that's what they really truly wanted to know, Whitman's brain had already done its work.
Do you know what it is as you pass to be loved by strangers?
Oh, to struggle against great odds, to meet enemies undaunted.
Oh, to attract by more than attraction.
Oh, my soul vibrated back to me from facts, from sight.
Oh, to work in mines or forging iron.
Oh, adhesiveness. Oh, pulse of my life.
And that story was produced by Michelle Legro.
You don't
Thank you so much for spending a little of your weekend listening time with us. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can listen on your own schedule with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. That helps others find it when shared by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio. Hey!